Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Manitoba has a way of clarifying things. Flat geography, open exposure, long supply lines. When something shifts, weather, prices, policy, it doesn't get absorbed quietly. It shows up quickly, and it shows up on the farm. That's the context Colin Hornby is working in at Keystone Agricultural Producers. Not an abstract agri-food system, but a province where grain, livestock, transport, and trade all intersect under conditions that don't leave much room for error. Flood one year, drought the next. Rail bottlenecks, input costs that arrive from somewhere else, but land here at home. What comes through in this conversation is how that environment shapes decision-making. Not just at the farm level, but inside an organization like CAP that has to represent producers who don't all want the same things, but are exposed to many of the same risks. In this episode, we talk about how policy travels from Ottawa into places like Manitoba, and where and how it loses coherence along the way. We get into the mechanics of risk management and what happens when the programs meant to stabilize the system start lagging behind the conditions they're meant to address. And we stay with a simple but difficult question. What does it mean to advocate for a sector when the ground it stands on keeps moving? This isn't a conversation about where agriculture is going. It's about what it looks like in a place where the future has already arrived, just not necessarily evenly. Now, a quick note on the audio quality. Colin only had one earbud in, so as a consequence, his stereo is only one side of the channel. Apologizes for this, but you know, in agricultural podcasts, sometimes it's the knowledge that matters most. All right, let's listen. Colin, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thanks, Jesse. Pleasure to be here.
Now, the first question that I love to throw at my guests, really designed as a kind of curveball to put you on your back feet. What does the future mean to you?
Opportunity. I mean, the future is going to be filled with issues and challenges like the current times are, but there's always a silver lining. I think there's always opportunities. We just need to find them. And, also, how do we make things better than they have been for us? I'm a new-ish parent. My wife and I had our first child last summer, and that's been an adventure. And I think wanting to leave a world a better place than what I came into it for my child and children, we'll see what happens. But I think that's ultimately a personal goal of mine, and I think that's something we can all do in our professional lives to try and advance things. I mean, agriculture, we're already seeing, you know, people talking about drones. We've been talking about them for years now, and we're starting to see finally some movement around regulations and what is that going to look like. So that is, the future is now, right? But that's one of those opportunities we can harness to see how we can make things better with it, right?
Right on. And now that you bring up the subject, for sure I want to talk drones with you today, only because I have yet to have the opportunity in the episodes we've done so far. But the second question that's been on the front of my mind as I've been kind of preparing for our chat and thinking about what I wanted to talk about is to talk about Manitoba. And I say that in such a broad, sweeping way, but I kind of feel that when you look at the Canadian agri-food sector, Manitoba's the powerhouse that doesn't get the respect that it deserves. Because on the one hand, you got Alberta and Saskatchewan who love to like throw themselves around and tell everyone how great they are, which is legit and fair. And then you got Ontario, which kind of thinks that it's the center of the universe and kind of acts that way. And in the middle, you got Manitoba, where I certainly know from my own experience, there's some phenomenal innovation going on within the agricultural sector. But I use the word powerhouse not lightly, because Manitoba really does globally kind of swing above its weight class. So am I right in thinking that you guys don't get the respect that you deserve? And let's start our chat out by giving our audience a sense of why Manitoba really is a player globally when it comes to the agri-food sector, and in particular, agri-food innovation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends who you talk to, right? You're right, Ontario thinks it's its own, the center of the world, the center of Canada. We're actually the center of Canada. Landmark Manitoba is the center of Canada, right? I live near there. So we're the second largest grower of potatoes in Canada. People think about PEI, no shade at PEI listeners, but we're number two behind Alberta. So I think that we do a very good job. We have Emily, the Enterprise Machine Institute, Learning Institute. I'm going to get that wrong, but Emily's Innovation Farms site is housed in Manitoba. That's a hub of innovation. We have the Glenlee Research Station hosts the Bruce D. Campbell Farm and Food Discovery Center. It's an opportunity where we have academia, we have industry, we have government, all working in one place to act as a center for education. We brought people from across Canada to the Farm and Food Discovery Center last summer, and people were blown away at this amazing functioning farm that we use as an educational tool. And, you know, it is like Rodney Dangerfield, no respect, right? Like sometimes we do feel that way in Manitoba. So I think we are a leader in that space. We're getting more into other types of agriculture. We have a massive Vermilion Growers in Dauphin has a new greenhouse in the north, you know, that region of the province. So I think there's a lot of things that we have to be proud of. There's a lot of talk about Churchill. What's the opportunities at the Port of Churchill? So I think it's also, we have an advantage in Manitoba when it comes to attracting labor. It's an affordable province relative to others when we look at house prices relative to what you can make in a job. So I think that's something else. We have the University of Manitoba, which is a great institution. I'm an alumni, I'm biased. We have Red River College, Polytech. We have all these institutions. We have so much to be proud of here. We're the core of the grain trading hub of Canada. We have the grain exchange, the exchange area. We have great restaurants, another thing. So I think all that to say Manitoba's a great place. I'm from here, I've lived here except for a few years of my life. So.
Right on. And I do want to talk about the Keystone Agricultural Producers in the context of kind of Manitoba's ongoing leadership, ongoing vision for the future. But I do want to take a moment to talk about your kind of professional background, because it's quite impressive. And I say this, you know, not just because you have all the key ingredients of providing the kind of experience for a leader to have, but because you've been engaged in the policy world, in the political world. And one of the through lines of our podcast is we want more people to do that. We want more people to see policy as a fun, cool place to really have an impact, and to not treat politics like a dirty word, but to your point, like an opportunity, right? Because it really is kind of what you make of it. So give me a bit of your lore. Give me a bit of your backstory, because, you know, certainly when I was scoping you out and looking on your LinkedIn, I was like, I'm really excited to talk to this guy.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, it's something I've always been attracted to politics my whole life. I go back to being, gosh, I don't know what year it would have been. I was thinking about this leading up to our conversation. My first distinct memory of politics was when John Kerry ran against George Bush. That is the first time I started to kind of click into, like, politics as a thing in my head. I remember Barack Obama getting elected. I remember Stephen Harper getting, like, the majority. All these different things that have happened, right? So for me, I mean, going through high school, I kind of always had that little itch. Getting into university, I never really thought there was a way to monetize that interest. So, yeah, I went to U of M, University of Manitoba. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a sports agent. I wanted to be a lawyer. And I wanted to be a teacher. You know, I couldn't really figure it out. I went and I took a year or two. I went to Red River College at the time, did my human resource management training, worked in HR for about 6 years for an HR consultant, fractional HR firm, and got involved volunteering for the Progressive Conservative Party and the Federal Conservative Party of Canada So I did some stuff there. I was able to get hired on a campaign for a federal campaign, and then was working as well as an intern at the provincial party. So that was sort of dipping my toe into it. Some people took a chance on me, and I'm forever thankful to them. From there, I was able to get a job at the legislature, working in the government caucus chair and government whip's office, so doing a lot of that sort of legislative stuff. Then I went over to Ottawa to work for a couple of years for a member of parliament from Winnipeg, Marty Morantz, who is a good friend of mine still to this day, and then went back to the premier's office here in Manitoba and got to be the manager of legislative affairs. So that whole, I mean, being involved in politics is something that really gets me out of bed, something that was interesting, but, you know, I did want a change in my life after doing that for a few years, and I saw the job at CAP as a communications and stakeholder relations manager. I took that on, was able to do some government relations there, and then ultimately when my predecessor moved on to another job, I applied and went through the process and was successful in this endeavor. So this is where I sit today.
Right on. And before we get to CAP, I want to unpack something you kind of glossed over there that I think is important, because another one of the pieces I keep looking for when I chat with people is kind of what gave them the skills to be the leaders they are today? And you kind of described it in terms of your political experience and your legislative experience, but spell it out. Like, what were the kind of skills that you kind of got from that experience? Because I say this in the sense that it's remarkable how many leaders, both in the sector, but across Canada, had that kind of formative experience that started off as volunteering, but then ended up in really interesting, unique opportunities where I think you learned stuff you're not going to learn at any school, University of Manitoba aside. Clearly that did have a positive impact on you, but give me a sense of what the things you learned in the political life that are not really available anywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, I think other duties as assigned, you know, everybody sees that on a job description, and then you really understand that when you do that job. It's a all-encompassing, you really have to believe in the cause in order to be in those jobs, right? Because at the end of the day, everybody in those types of roles is working together towards one common goal. And I think it really underscores that importance in a team setting. I would say also football, playing football, I played through high school and coached afterwards. I coached for 8 years or so. I lost track of it. But coaching sports has delivered so many lessons to me. I think understanding that servant leadership mindset, being as a leader, your role is not to advance your own interests or to advance anyone in particular. It's to support those around you, because you want to get people that are better than you at particular tasks, and you want to support them to be successful, because ultimately that's what's important. So, and something else in politics that, too, I always have sort of been interested in is the idea that politics is the art of the possible. So it's how do we, you know, it's not a science. Like, yes, there's political scientists and they'll talk about things, but at the end of the day, it's an art, too. It's how do we get things done, building coalitions. In the role I was in the legislature, I had to work with other parties to advance priorities in the chamber. So it was working with the opposition party to say, okay, you know, you have to have a positive relationship with them and talk about what you're doing and what they're doing, what are your plans, and sort of, okay, if we want to get this advanced, we're on a time constraint, what can we do for you? Sort of that bargaining. So I think there's that collaborative part too, where yes, you don't agree with that person, but they're not your enemy. They're there doing their job. They believe in something, you believe in something. And it's just a matter of how do we advance our respective agendas, because everybody can win in a lot of these instances. So those are some of the things I think that I would say I've learned from that, as well as the coaching piece, for sure.
Right on. And that, I think, very much fits with the values of the agricultural sector, of the agri-food sector, because I think there is a desire for everyone to work together, to find that kind of commonality that really empowers people. And I will admit, one of the things that I love about this particular gig of hosting this podcast is learning about organizations like CAP and learning about the organizations that kind of support the sector across the country. So again, for those of us in Ontario who have been burdened by our own insularity, help me understand CAP, both its kind of general history, but also its current focus in terms of what your priorities are in terms of the role that the organization plays in the sector.
Yeah, so CAP was founded in 1984, so we celebrated 40 years recently. We started off in sort of a different format. It was a door-to-door selling memberships, but we became the certified organization for Manitoba farmers. We're a general farm group. Our focus is around ensuring a prosperous future for all Manitoba farmers. So we are that general farm group policy organization here in Ontario. Think OFA. We're just like OFA in that regard. So we're focused on policy. How do we bring people together? How do we find areas of alignment and figuring out what's good for the goose is good for the gander, kind of, if you think about it that way. Again, I talk about that prosperous future for all farmers. It's not about just one type of a farmer or one crop or one livestock type of livestock. It's about all farmers, and that's who we're here to serve. We're directed by farmers. Our board is farmers. They're elected by their fellow farmers. So that is sort of the structure. We have 12 districts. We also have four other commodity seats on our board. So one is to represent red meat groups, one is for grains, oilseeds, and pulse groups, another is for specialty crops, and another is for supply management. So, I mean, that's another component as being a general farm group. You know, there is a lot of talk in the trade space right now around what is Canada going to bargain or put up in these negotiations, if that's what we come to. There is some sentiments around supply management. Should it be on the table? Should it not be on the table? Ultimately, we have members that are supply managed, so that is important to us. We put forward a trade action plan to the province of Manitoba, and one of the things in there is around respecting the diversity of Manitoba's agricultural production, one of those being supply management. So all that to say, we're looking at what are policy changes, regulatory changes, things like that, where we can help that would be good for all farmers. We see ourselves as well as we provide benefits as well to our members around discounts and insurance and all that type of stuff. So we are structured in a way a bit like a chamber of commerce. So how do we provide that value? What is the value proposition to our members? And something else that's really important to me is, not, yes, it's important that we advocate for farmers, but we have to advocate for the sector, because if processors are going to succeed, yes, it can't be at the expense of farmers, but if they can both succeed, well, that's a win to us. So we work with all parts of the value chain. We don't just talk to farmers. So that's very important to us. And we're also members of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture, so that is sort of our national voice. So we do try to stay in that provincial lane, but ultimately there are issues that do enter our space that are federal. So we do work across jurisdictions, municipal issues as well, around like bylaw, zoning, land use planning, etc. So a lot of things, a lot of problems, a lot of issues, a lot of opportunities, alluding to what I said earlier. I think right now, one of the big things is we're seeing how do we navigate this new federal government with Prime Minister Carney. We have seen, I would say, an improvement from the previous administration around being receptive to feedback changes, so that has been positive for us. And of course, trade is top of mind. That's all we talk about. I'll be going to Washington next week as part of another conference, but extending that a bit to do some discussions with some American groups. So very important to nurture that relationship with the U.S. and Mexico. We've been down to Mexico as well, so there's a lot going on.
And I definitely want to kind of tap your brain around the leadership challenges of having such a diverse set of constituents, especially to your point about the supply management folks versus potentially the grain folks and any differences they might have. But to your point about, you know, thinking about trade and thinking about federal policy, What would you identify as like specific Manitoba issues compared to issues that might apply to the sector as a whole or might apply to grain farmers as a whole? Like I'm assuming that there are elements specific either to your industries or even to your geography that kind of give you a different perspective when you're sitting at the table with the CFA or when you're sitting in Washington kind of looking at the larger continental picture.
Yeah, I think for us, I mean, one of the challenges is our proximity to port, right? We're just in the center. I mean, the Port of Churchill is an interesting opportunity, but it's not something that's going to happen in the next year. And there's questions around, you know, how will that impact agricultural exports and whether or not it will be impactful enough. So for us, it's obviously Vancouver, Thunder Bay. Those are kind of, we're at the mercy of those. So we got to go a long way to get stuff. So that for us is more unique than, say, BC producers. Looking at it from at a provincial jurisdictional level, we have unique tax challenges in Manitoba that other provinces don't have. So we have a decentralized property tax structure where we have locally elected authorities, school trustees, that are setting the rate for taxation on property tax, for farmland school tax. So there has been, over the last few years, the previous government brought in a commitment to reduce that every year over 10 years. So it kind of stuck at 50% and it's stayed there. So there is a 50% reduction that people do get back as a credit. But something that we do have is the model we have, and again, something CAP is one of the founding issues, I think, going back into the 80s, was this structure and the disproportionate impact that we see farmland paying on tax relative to urban users or urban ratepayers rather. So I would say that's a uniquely Manitoba issue. We do have some challenges. We're very flat. So with water management, there are some different rules. Drainage is a topic that came up at our last annual meeting from our members in a variety of areas in the province. So something we're sort of working through now with producers and municipalities in the province and other stakeholders. So I think those are some of the, I would say, issues in the potato sector as well. I mean, I think it's 97% of our processed potatoes go to the U.S. So the importance of open trade with the U.S. through CUSMA is one that's very, very top of mind for us in the potato sector, as well as our footprint in the pork sector. So we ship a lot of live weanlings into the U.S. We have agreements going into Iowa and Minnesota and other places like that. So country of origin labeling in the U.S. and Proposition 12 out of California, these are issues that very strongly impact us as a pork producing province. So I think those would be some of the maybe things that are at the top of our mind when we talk about Manitoba's sort of things that maybe we care significantly about.
Well, and when you mentioned the kind of access to ports, immediately I thought of highways into the U.S. That is a kind of transportation infrastructure that I'm assuming, to your point, that Manitoba's benefited from. You know, the country of origin stuff does seem to be a particularly important issue, a variable, given how I'm getting all sorts of signals how that's going to play out. I'd love for you to elaborate on that and highlight some of the other things that you're going to be focusing on when you head south, you know, both in terms of kind of building natural alliances. We do have lots of friends in the U.S. agri-food sector who work with us, who depend upon us. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you're reaching out to them. But to your point, what are the priorities? And I'd love for you to start by elaborating on the country of origin stuff, because I think for those paying attention, they understand how important it is. But it seems one of those things that could be lost on members of the sector, let alone the general public, who aren't following this particular important issue.
Yeah, so I think if you talk about VCOOL, we call it Voluntary Country of Origin Labeling, which is a policy brought in by USDA, basically says if you want to be labeled as a product of USA, you have to comply with certain requirements around the animal has to go from birth all the way through to packaging in America. So given the integration of the supply chain with Canada and the US and pork, which is the example we always give, and I want to give a shout out to Cam Dahl from Manitoba Pork, who has been a leader in this, as well as the Prop 12. And we're very lucky in Manitoba to have Cam working on the pork file. He's been phenomenal with his team at Manitoba Pork. So right now, products can say product of USA, or not now, because as of January, this came into place, but prior to the VQOL rules, I could say product of USA, even if it was originated from Manitoba and the rest of the steps were in the US. So the concern is that even though it's voluntary, if you have large, big box stores, supermarkets who say, you know what, no, we want to comply, we're only going to buy pork that meets this requirement, that's a problem because the producers in the US, the pork producers rely on Manitoba. And another thing is our genetics are globally known that Manitoba has the best swine genetics, or some of the best, I'm going to say the best swine genetics in the world, in particular in markets like in Japan, where they look out for, or they seek out our pork. So the American pork producers do not like this policy. So we have, as to your point, we have friends in America who are supportive. So the VQOL issue is one that for sure that's kind of the impact is if these American producers can no longer purchase their weanlings from Canada, there's nowhere else for them to get them at this point. So it would cause a huge problem. So this is something that they know in the US, the Americans know. And I think it's a matter of working through these issues. And I'm hopeful that there will be a resolution, but I'm not sure. So that's one of the big issues, I think. We also
Just
try to maintain strong on. Go
and
ahead.
just on that
Yeah.
point, correct me if I'm wrong, is the larger American issue not so much concern about Canadian, but rather South American imports? That it feels to me like we're kind of getting caught in this larger policy sweep when the industry absolutely wants to be working with us, but the fear is cheap imports, not from Canada, but from elsewhere in the world. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I would say that's a fair assessment. Canada is not really the big concern in our opinion. Our quality is very high. We work well with them. They rely on us, as I mentioned earlier. So I think, I think that's right. And it's another thing. It's this almost food nationalism idea where we're seeing there's a strong economic populist nationalist sort of sentiment in the U.S. This has been happening for many years. This just didn't just sneak up on us when President Trump was elected. This has been ongoing. So I think it's part of a broader sort of national mentality around. And look, if we think about it as a Canadian too, how many Canadians do you talk to who say, "Well, I want to buy product of Canada. I want something that says product of Canada," right? And that's as far as a lot of consumers are thinking is, "Well, I want to support local farmers in Canada. I would rather my money stay here." And I mean, sure, that's a good sentiment. I understand it. But the integration of our countries, I personally would prefer to support a Canadian farmer, right? But if I know, I mean, because I understand a bit more around the supply chain and how these things get to the shelf, I know there's Canadian support and Canadian inputs into the whole product in many instances. So, yeah, I think you're right.
Sorry, you were going to talk about some of the other stuff you were going to focus on, communicating and conveying when you were in the States.
So the interesting thing is understanding. So we have been supporters of it's an organization called SARL. It's the State Ag Rural Leaders. It's an organization based out of the U.S., but they have American and Canadian legislators. And every year there's something called the Ag Chair Summit, and it rotates different spots. So we sponsor that event, and we were down in Des Moines 2 years ago, and then or last year, I guess, and this year we were in New Orleans. And it's an opportunity to talk with American legislators. We send a Canadian delegation. It's a great place to have that discussion. And the more we talk, we look at the agenda, and they have what's called speed dating. And the speed dating sessions are, let's talk about land use policy and taxation policy and urban sprawl and all these different things. And you sit down with somebody from Kansas, and I'm from Manitoba, which you know, sometimes people aren't sure where that is. And it's like, oh yeah, we have the same problem. Like, I think it's getting across, like, you know, we have the same problems. And I think also, this is feedback we've heard from people who are trade professionals. We've heard this from Ambassador Hextra, Pete Hextra, as well, that we shouldn't be going to the U.S. and saying, why are you being mean to us? You're hurting our feelings. Well, that doesn't sell in America. We're here to talk about why Canada is a great trade partner for America and what can we give to you? How can you benefit from us? That is what we need to be doing. And I think we also need to make sure that we're coordinating as a sector and across industries too to say, what are those key messages that we're talking about? And I mean, we're trying to do this also in an environment of the midterms. So it's really hard because they're congressmen and women and senators are focused on one thing, well, two things, getting reelected and raising money, and those go hand in hand. So I think we also need to be mindful of that. So right now, maybe it's not about specific issues. It's maybe more about relationships, commonality, expanding our networks. But yeah, those pinch points in CUSMA, I think we've called for a renewal of the agreement along with 100, I think there was 100 or so of us groups in Canada. There was 116 groups in the U.S. Farm groups have all talked about, let's renew the agreement, let's move forward, let's deal with some of the more, you know, the regulatory challenges through things like the Regulatory Cooperation Council, which is intended to deal with those things, and through other dialogue, one-off agreements, whatever it may be. So I think, you know, we can say yes, you know, CUSMA has been successful. This administration has negotiated a good deal. CUSMA has been successful for Canada and the U.S., just like NAFTA was. We dealt with some of the challenges. Let's renew it. Let's move forward. Let's continue to be trading partners. And that's kind of the focus.
Right on. And I mean, you said something earlier that I want to come back to, and this is to give you a heads up. I do want to talk about kind of the regulatory environment and regulatory obstacles. But there is this kind of holy grail within the agricultural sector of getting everyone on the same page, of kind of getting everyone speaking with a kind of unity and focus. And you've been evoking that throughout our conversation today. And I'm curious how CAP, with the diverse subsector organizations, the diverse farmers and other organizations who are part of your network, part of your ecosystem, how do you accomplish that? Like, what's your strategy either in getting everyone to focus on a key priority or a key initiative so you have that kind of clarity, or conversely, managing differences and making sure that people do have a sense that they're in it together? Because again, I kind of sense you're taking that for granted. And maybe it's because it's something that you do so regularly, you just kind of assume that it's part of your repertoire. But I think it is a difficult challenge for a lot of sectoral leaders, especially in this moment of uncertainty, where whether it's the regulatory environment, whether it's the trade environment, it just feels like anything can change at any moment. And getting people to focus on the same thing, to be on the same team, can be kind of challenging.
Yeah, that's an understatement. Like, that's the challenge we deal with every day, I think, is finding those, what are the things? Because we're not going to deal, like, we're not going to find a position on every issue that everybody agrees with. It's just not, I'd be a fool to say that. So I think a big part of it is being accessible to our members, being accessible to different groups, constantly looking for coalitions, not just within agriculture, but outside of agriculture too. We've worked with the oil and gas sector on different issues to advance common interests. You know, there's forestry, there's other sectors that deal with similar problems. Regulatory burden, for example, is something that every industry deals with, right? So how do we learn from each other for how in our respective sectors we're able to get that sort of regulatory reform or improvement? But I think it comes down to listening. You need to listen to people to understand where they're coming from. And I think if you do that, they're more willing to listen to you. And, you know, some people, let's say there's an issue that somebody's hot under the collar about, and they're coming at you, right? And they say, ah, like, I'm angry about something. And as you just let them talk, listen, it can be disarming, you know? And then it's like, okay, and you understand that person or that sector. And I think it's, you know, we're looking to achieve the same thing. Our vision, our mission, prosperous future for all Manitoba farmers. Who can disagree with that? So how do you fit into that as a group, as a sector? And yes, we're not always going to agree, and we need to be understanding of that, and we need to recognize and accept that. But what are the things that we can advance together? Like, yes, if you and I are at diametric ends of the spectrum on an issue, if you think the sky's red and I think the sky's blue, well, that's kind of a hard thing to find a middle point. So how do we find another issue where we can work together on? So there are those things. There's tax policy. There's different regulatory policy issues. There's, you know, everybody thinks there should be improvements to business risk management programs. Well, okay, what are those improvements? Let's talk about that. How's your sector affected? And maybe it's the same if you're in beef or you're in pork. Maybe you're affected the same way as a potato grower is, or wheat, somebody who's, you know, got wheats and barley and everything else. So it's just, what are those commonalities? And it takes time and it takes effort and it takes listening, and it's not always fun, but that's what we do, and that's what we're very passionate about doing. That is the life of a general farm organization.
Right on. And
we need
and
to
that's
meet people where they are. That's the other thing.
And that's a great answer, because it on the one hand speaks to the necessary humility, right? Like, on the one hand, you have to know what is the art of the possible, as you said earlier. But on the other hand, it is, I think, about allocating attention, that you find the things where people can come together. Now, so far in our conversation, for kind of my own selfish purposes, I've been getting you to focus on Manitoba so that I could, you know, get the crash course that I've clearly required. But let's scale this up, you know, federally across the country. What do you think are some of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to issues that people can really come together on, that are the types of things where the sector, you know, perhaps can command the attention of the federal government, which I will be the first to say, like Manitoba, does not always get the respect that it deserves? Or similarly, what are the kind of initiatives? What are the kind of rallying points, you know, that given the opportunity, you think on a national level, the various elements of the sector should be prioritizing and focusing on?
Well, I think elevating agriculture as a core industry of Canada is important. That's not something that we've seen federal governments always talk about. So it's been, you know, we met with Senator Rob Black some time ago. This was last month, maybe. We've met with him a few times, and he talked about how when he first got elected to the Senate, agriculture was mentioned maybe once or twice, and now it's mentioned all the time. So he has seen that in his period there. It's good to see. It can always be more. So how do we elevate? And for us, obviously, our context is prairie agriculture, right? So those types of crops, canola, etc. So Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, we haven't held significant political clout in government for the last 10 years. That's just the way it's been. The government has not had any representation from those provinces. Mostly, Manitoba has been sort of the outlier. We actually are unique in the prairies, where we have we've historically had some of every party. So that's something for us that's important, and I think is something that we can all agree on. When Mark Carney became the prime minister, agricultural groups all co-signed a letter outlining our priorities and say, hey, we're agriculture, we're here. Agri-food processing, agri-food manufacturing is the biggest manufacturing sector in Canada. I'm sure you've heard that before. So that's something we need to talk about. And we need to say we're driving economic growth in this country. There's a focus on economic growth. There's a focus on competitiveness. There's a focus on national security. Well, food security is national security, right? So these are things that agriculture can play a huge role in. We also can help solve any challenges when we're looking, say, in northern communities, if there's food security challenges. Agriculture has the answer. If there's a problem, we tend to have the answer, and if we don't, we'll find it. So those are things for sure. I think we've seen a promising refreshing change in approach to how we're dealing with solving problems and listening to industry. So we've seen a government now federally that is trying to be more collaborative with industry. We're looking at a focus on the economic components of the business and understanding that that's what's important at this critical time where we're seeing a lot of challenges globally. So I think, I talked about regulatory reform earlier. We're seeing the PMRA, which is now the PRD, so it's becoming a directorate. They're putting out their regulations on drones, and that's going to be putting us at an equal footing, hopefully, to the U.S., right? We've been saying for some time now that other countries have access to products and technologies that we don't. Why is that? There was legislation put forward by Cody Bloys a few years ago that would have allowed for a regulatory approval in Canada if a product was approved, a chemical product was approved in another trusted jurisdiction within a certain 30 days or 60 days or whatever it is. So things like that, where why is the EPA's data not as good as Canada's, right? So things like that, where we're able to say have government move at the speed of business. Probably heard that adage from groups before. So that's good. Those are good things. This focus on the economy and the issues that matter to people in everyday lives, in their everyday lives and their businesses. Something else I think is farm transitions. How do we get young producers into farm, into agriculture, or how do we support them through the transition? Say, you know, the typical sort of storyline is somebody was a farmer, their father or their mother or both of their parents were the farmers, and they've passed on the farm to them. Some of these farms are supporting 3, 4, 5 different families, making sure that their structure reflects that, making sure that they're able to pass it down. We're looking at instances now where it's going, it's not just the children, because sometimes the children don't want to go into farming, or there is no children, but there's a cousin or whatever. So making sure that the rules around taxation and succession match that. People who don't work in agriculture, or people who don't come from agriculture, like myself, who 4 years ago couldn't tell you what a grain jar was, or 5 years. I don't want to say that if I'd already started here, but how do we get more people who are not agriculture aggies to come into ag and to work in ag? Because we're also moving into a time where we're going to see different sets of skills, and making sure that groups like the Canadian Ag Human Resource Council does a lot of work on what are those skills that are needed, what are those jobs that are needed. How do we have those supporting industries or supporting jobs in agriculture, not just on farm? What is the future? To your early question, your first question, it sounds like you're interested in the future. Maybe you're a futurist. But I think, how do we enable the sector for success by attracting people and students into the sector? This is something that we're doing in Manitoba. We've got funding to set up a portal to attract people to agriculture. You know, I like to talk about making agriculture sexy. Like, let's get people into it. How do we do that? So that's another thing.
I mean, you're preaching to a true believer over here, and that I think that there are a bunch of nerds, a bunch of really curious, imaginative people stuck in cities who would love to be spending their days playing with robots on the farm, let alone using the heavy machinery and getting their hands dirty. So I think there is tremendous potential in finding ways to get new blood in, but to your point, also facilitating transitions within families in a much easier, less stressful manner. But I do want to dig a little deeper into the drone stuff, though, only because I am personally a big drone proponent. I have a drone. I've actually started researching building my own custom drone. So let's talk a little about the regulatory environment, because you raised some issues that were new to me. I was kind of anticipating you getting into some of the pilot's license stuff. Like, I personally think that farmers should have an exemption to flying drones on their farms. teams without necessarily having to go through the pilot's license and all that stuff. Again, possibly uninformed opinion on my part. But I want to dig deeper into kind of the regulatory stuff, but let's stick to drones as an example. I'd love for you to unpack that a little more, and let's do it in a forward-looking way. What would the ideal regulatory environment that encourages drone adoption and drone experimentation in the agricultural sector, what would that look like?
So I think we need to make it, I mean, I don't think you need to make it easy because, or enticing, because it is enticing. Because you look at what it costs to, say, buy 3 or 4 drones, you set up your sort of drone carrier. We saw them at Ag Days this past year. It's like an aircraft carrier. Well, it is an aircraft carrier. And they just, go one goes and comes back and charges and the other goes and all that stuff. I do think, though, we can't exempt fully. We need to make sure that we do have some sort of rules in place around, you know, making sure there's some basics understood about safety, about, you know, because ultimately that's another thing. You're going to have an object that flies that is spraying chemicals. So I think if we want the public, we talk a lot about public trust in agriculture, right? So if we want to maintain that and we want to make sure that people trust, because people do trust farmers, generally speaking, data shows that consistently. How do we keep that? We don't want to erode that. And we want to make sure that people operating drones and people in neighboring areas do not, you know, accidentally get sprayed or something. So I think in our view, we think that if a product is cleared for aerial application, it's cleared for aerial application, right? Now, there is some debate around drift and things like that, and I think that can get ironed out. And companies that are the registrants of these products are not going, like a Bayer, Syngenta, BASF, whoever, they're not going to want to put a product as an aerial application if they don't feel comfortable or confident that it could cause drift or damage or off-target damage or anything like that. So those companies may say, we don't want it used for that. They're not going to put it on the label that it's used for a drone, whatever it is. So I think the way we see it is that there should be some basics. You know, you look at Manitoba, we have for the Class 1 training for driving semis, we have what's called MELT, it's a mandatory entry level training program. So it's a bit of a compressed, makes it a little bit easier for producers to get their Class 1 training. So making it advantageous in that way, I think would be something that would be helpful. And again, that sort of, if it's aerial, it's aerial. Let's go. That's how it is in other places. That's how we would like to see it. And we provided feedback to PMRA on their consultation. And, you know, we talked about, we think it should be, we should be allowing aerial application for products with drones and just some other technical things about, you know, some of the proposed things they had didn't necessarily make sense. There was something about gloves and, you know, maybe that's not necessary while you're operating a drone. It's kind of hard to do. So,
and I guess where my own naivety is such that I would imagine that the applications themselves would be the area of regulation, but that the drone itself, not so much. And I say this partly because, and this may be a byproduct of my advanced technological literacy, I actually believe that the technology left to developers is going to be far more safe and secure than it would under any regulatory environment. And like, for example, that's currently my attitude about AI, that I'm really uncomfortable around kind of state-based efforts to make AI safe when I kind of find the industry is going to do a better job of that on their own due to their expertise. I'm digressing, but to bring it back to this notion of regulation, I kind of feel my own conflict that I used to be someone who was very pro-regulation, the right regulation, right? The belief that just like policy can be good or bad, regulation can be good or bad, and it really comes down to the configuration, the nuance of it.
But I am starting to come to this position as a farmer where I'm kind of drinking the Kool-Aid and starting to get to the idea that, you know what, maybe regulation is by default bad. I'm saying this full transparency in the sense that this is my own foolishness. So allow me to articulate a question to tap into your wisdom. How do we walk that line as a sector where on the one hand, I think there is widespread regulatory fatigue, that there are a lot of regulations that the sector is really tired with. But to your larger point, there is a notion of public trust that the people outside the sector do want to see us embracing certain rules and certain regulations. So where is the line in the political climate we're in today where there is, I think, a lot of sentiment amongst the sector that we should be leading and we should have less restraints? But at the same time, regulation plays an important role as a trust framework, as a kind of bridge for fostering. So I'm rambling. Again, Colin, this is where I'm deferring to your leadership. Where do you see this? Where do you see that line, that tightrope that as a leader, you kind of got to walk to get everyone on the same page?
So I would say, you know, generally speaking, like over-regulation is bad. Misguided regulation is bad. And to say which is good and which is bad, I mean, that for experts, you talked about industry experts. So I think we need industry to lead what should be, what makes sense. And we need governments to listen. So I think we need to, you know, I've always been a fan of 2-for-1 regulatory, you know, or 3-for-1. Put in one, you got to take two out. It's a good sort of check for government to make sure they're doing it smartly. So I think I think if I knew the answer to your question, I would probably be a very rich man if I knew exactly what the line was. But from my standpoint, I think it's making sure that, as it goes back to when we talk about speaking with one voice, right? We need to make sure that agriculture and the experts in the industry are going to government with similar things so that they can hear, okay, it's very clear to us that maybe we shouldn't do this with a regulation and maybe we should do this. Like, there needs to be a unified position from the industry side, and we need to make sure that the government knows why and have a good thought out case before they set or put a regulation in place. And the thing with regulations is they do have a process. It's a lot easier to make regulatory changes than it is to make legislative changes. Good luck. Legislative changes are like, it's crazy. We saw what happened with the carbon tax and the C-234, which ultimately got removed. But it was just, especially when you get into the federal space, it's like things get hunted to the Senate and change and go to committee and bounce back and forth. And, you know, people find legislative loopholes for delaying and delaying and delaying and delaying. And so it's regulations are a good tool that can be used to get things done quickly. This has to be done smartly. So I don't know if I answered your question. I probably didn't. I might have also gone on a bit of a soapbox, but
totally, yeah, appropriate.
I think that's kind of my perspective. Yeah, I thought so.
Well, and you know, part of my job in throwing the questions I do on this podcast is to make them as crazy and as difficult as possible. And you have performed spectacularly. So kudos to you, Colin. And unfortunately, we're coming to the end. And this is where I always have as my second last question, a kind of open-ended. But in your case, I'm going to make it a kind of double-ender in the sense that you can answer both parts or one or dodge entirely. And on the one hand, the question is always, is there anything that we haven't touched upon today that you really want to get into before we conclude? But similarly, the question I like to ask to policy pros like yourself is there a policy? Is there a policy concept that you're currently really keen on that you kind of want to throw out there to get more people paying attention to?
Well, I think I think I liked a lot of the direction we went on the questions. I mean, talking about a lot of our priorities, obviously trade and regulatory reform are two big ones. Some of those Manitoba flavors too, around taxation policy and stuff. I mean, ultimately, the way we see ourselves at CAP is it comes back to that mission of a prosperous future for all Manitoba farmers. And how do we make their lives easier? How do we make their business more prosperous, make their business easier, their day-to-day? What is causing them problems, and how do we fix it? And is there a commonality of if a farm here and a farm here and a farm here starts to say the same thing, well, maybe this is a bigger issue than just one. So that's something I think through our engagement. I mean, engagement and outreach is one of our four core pillars as an organization, making sure that we stay engaged and that we do that outreach with our members and other stakeholders. That's critically important to informing the work that we do. I don't go to a farm yard every day. I don't get up at 5 a.m. to go do something in the field or make sure the cows are getting milked, or, you know, somebody's calving and it's 2 a.m. and they got to get up because that's what they got to do. I could never do that. I'm thankful to farmers for everything they do to make sure that I can eat and that people can eat and have food, fuel, fiber, and all the things that we enjoy in this world that people take for granted. Which, I'll be honest, before I worked in agriculture, I might have taken for granted a little bit. And now that I understand a little more, I will go, okay, now I know the importance of the industry. So in terms of a policy concept, I don't know. Like, I think the idea of sort of the regulatory sandbox approach where you kind of allow for different experimentation, so to speak. I mean, we know that I'm not going to be naive. I know some farmers do that anyway. They're going to experiment with things that maybe aren't within the rules fully. We can't encourage that, of course, but having regulatory sandboxes is a good idea to allow for creativity and innovation. How do we enable innovation in Canada in agriculture, I think, is important. We're moving into such, you know, to agriculture people, there's this perception sometimes in the public around somebody with a red barn and a pitchfork and a couple of chickens and pigs. That's them. No, these are multi-million dollar business owners who are operating multi-million dollar equipment, and their technologies, and they're experts in the market, and they're experts in agrology and agronomy, and they understand how trade works, and they understand how to fix everything. And it blows my mind. I talk to farmers sometimes on our board. I go, you're a CEO and you're fixing a tractor and you're like, you're doing all of these things. And to me, it's, you know, some of the most entrepreneurial, solution oriented people that I've ever met. So how do we make their lives easier? I think is smarter, more efficient policy, governments, you know, my personal view, I think that the government should be very limited in how it involves itself in society. It should be creating an environment for success for people, for businesses, for, you know, but still being able to support people who need that help. So ultimately, I don't know if I answered your question again, but I tried. And I just want to say thank you for having me on, and I appreciate all the questions. And well, hopefully we can achieve that better future with prosperity and making the world better than we entered it.
And you did answer it quite spectacularly, because I love the concept of the regulatory sandbox. And, you know, I'm familiar with it in the startup space and in the technology space. But to your point about agriculture, it's kind of already exists, because you're right. There are a lot of farmers who are experimenting in ways that might be like the technology sector, outpacing the expected regulatory regime. And I think we would empower these entrepreneurs, we would empower these innovators if we were to be able to offer that kind of regulatory sandbox, not just a regulatory sandbox, to your point about taxation, you know, the provide the type of tax incentives that do exist in other areas around R&D, around technology, that kind of are in place in the agricultural sector, but not in the way that it could be, to your point about the regulatory sandbox. So right on. Our last question, to your point about gratitude, it's real quick and brief, and it's the shout outs, which you, to your credit, you already have given a couple of shout outs throughout the episode today. But again, the idea here is, there are any leaders that you're paying attention to that you think the rest of us should be paying attention to?
Yeah, certainly. And I just want to say, we never even talked about AAFC research cuts, and we made it an hour without saying that, because you just said research, and I thought, oh, we didn't even talk about that. But that can be a conversation for another day, and I think would be a good one for you to have with somebody. I would say leaders. I mean, my predecessor, who is also a friend of mine, Brenna Mahoney, who's the manager of government and public affairs for BASF, is somebody who's helped mentor me. Cam Dahl from Manitoba Pork. These are two people that I think are strong leaders. Yeah, those would be the two that jump out to me for sure in agriculture.
Right on. And to your point, we definitely have to have you back. I mean, I structure these episodes at an hour because of my own ADHD and the kind of assumption of the audience out there. But we've got a kind of format where we've got cooking in the kitchen, which, you know, we're bringing people into the herd kind of one by one, but then we're bringing panels together to get some of these leaders kind of interacting and cross-pollinating around issues. And I agree. The AAFC research cuts are a huge issue, and they're not one that's kind of ended, in the sense that they've created an opportunity to talk about what kind of research we should be doing as a sector and how it supports rural economic development and rural infrastructure. So I'm really glad you got that in before the buzzer. Thanks again, Colin, and for sure, we definitely have to get you back.
You bet. Thanks, Jesse. Great to be here.
Manitoba doesn't resolve itself neatly, and neither does this conversation. What Colin offers isn't a position so much as a vantage point. From Keystone Agriculture producers, you can see how decisions made elsewhere, federal policy, global markets, input pricing, arrive on the farm and get translated into something workable or not. You can also see where that translation starts to break down. There's a tendency to look for alignment in agriculture, a unified voice, a shared direction. What comes through here is something more fragmented, and yet also more real. Different operations, different pressures, different timelines, held together not by agreement, but by exposure to the same conditions. That leaves an open question, however. If the system depends on organizations like CAP to hold those differences together, what happens as the gap widens? When volatility isn't episodic but constant, and when adaptation becomes less about adjustment and more about endurance? This conversation doesn't try to settle any of that. It stays instead with the work as it is. Representing, negotiating, stabilizing, while the ground keeps moving. That may be the clearest signal of where things stand. Until next time, I think I'm Jesse Hirsch.